On today's show, Panhandle Town Council really wants you to work for those backyard chickens. And Yarjo has the town talking about convoys. This is Panhandle Talk Radio. And welcome back to the show. My name is Brian Constantine. I am here with my co-host, Michael Rowland.
Hello, hello.
Thank you for joining us again. We are going to get right into it. Normally, you know, we struggle to try to find a Penhold angle. We kind of look at bigger topics, and because that's going to affect everybody. But it's nice when we can call ourselves Penhold Talk Radio and actually talk specifically about Penhold. And I think for the most part, this whole show is going to be addressed about things that have gone on around town. And so we're going to start again back with town council. So they again had their meeting. They have a meeting every 2 weeks, and there's a few different things that are kind of interest. They talked about some early steps on a new school. There's some variance talk, you know, nothing too exciting there, but there's steps towards a new school. Kind of more procedural steps there. There is actually some talk about getting live streaming going in the multiplex, which I must say I hope is better than the live stream of town council meetings. I'll just throw it out there. But the main thing, again, we want to talk about is chickens.
The oh-so-controversial topic of town lately.
We will not shy away from this topic. We will not be scared. We will not be intimidated. We will not be censored about chickens. So last meeting, the council voted and passed the first reading of the new bylaw regarding urban chickens. And I mentioned on that episode that when council records a vote in their minutes, they don't actually record the specific votes. And they just simply mentioned that it was carried or carried unanimously. And so you don't know who the individual votes were. Yeah. So I was watching this last council meeting. And so I was able to ask them about the specific vote on the first reading. And so here it is, breaking news. On the very first reading, the vote was split 5-2. So five voted to pass the first reading and two were against it. And the two that were against it were Councillors Denson and Councillor Walsh voted against the bylaw. So just for the record, so you know who is voting in what way. Just as a matter of transparency, as far as I'm concerned, this is transparency. This is what you should know already.
If you're voting for somebody in a position in politics, you want to know how they are voting when they have a decision to make.
Yeah, someone's voting record. Yeah, like is one of the main ways I think you should be determining your vote.
Yeah,
it'll definitely show you where someone wants to steer things. And so that was the vote 5-2 last time, and they came back with to talk about the bylaw again this week or this last council meeting, and it was more to look at some supporting documents that council had asked the administration to bring. And so it provides a little bit more clarity to where they think this policy is going to go or how they want it to be shaped. So again, we talked last time about really how kind of onerous and difficult, I guess, to get chickens in town looks like it's going to be. And so looking at the new documents, it's in fact gotten harder, I think, since last time.
Yeah, that kind of shocked me. It looks worse than it did before.
Yeah, I guess our the weight of this show is not enough yet. We haven't been able to influence council yet. I don't understand why. but anyways, so they are reading kind of from their draft, the draft of this bylaw. Again, chickens would be capped, you would not be allowed to get any more than four hens per property per your backyard. No roosters. There'd be no more than 25 licenses given out across town. And then, but to actually get a license, and even before you can actually apply, there's a significant amount of steps that you have to go through. I actually kind of like, because in kind of the preamble to this, the bylaw says it is not in your best interest to invest in chickens, equipment, etc., until you obtain your permit. Okay, reasonable, sure. But you have to, I think, put in a significant amount of time and perhaps money, yeah, even to get to the application stage, let alone the license stage.
Yep.
So it goes through, it says review town or the bylaws, of course. Step two, you have to go through an urban hen keeping course. And here they do provide a couple courses that you can go to, perhaps online. But you go through it and you actually get a certificate for chicken handling, backyard, and it's actually for backyard chickens. A course that you have to go through, again, before you even apply, you have to go through this course. So I'm assuming it takes some time and money to go through it, even if it is a single day. Nonetheless, it's a course you have to go through. You have to get one of those premises identification numbers. Again, this seemed to be something that's more geared to controlling disease outbreak and animal tracking.
Yeah, based on the way it's written, it certainly sounds like it's more of a agricultural farming type,
yeah,
program, not intended for a few backyard chickens that could almost be called pets.
Yeah, I think in many cases people see them that way. I will note that this has actually been a common one across all the other chicken bylaws I was kind of skimming over. That this requirement for this identification number is actually kind of a common thread through all of them. So I guess that's not necessarily new or an additional regulation for Penhold, but it's there nonetheless. Step four, it says obtaining your development permit. So here, because you need some sort of coop to keep them in, you may have to actually require some sort of electrical system or tie into your home electronic or home electrical system. And in order to do that, you would need some sort of permit, and it gives you some recommendations there of what you would need to do to get that permit.
What if I just run an extension cord out to it?
That's kind of what I was thinking.
Could you not just run a space heater on an extension cord or something to that effect?
That's kind of how I would think, but I haven't gone through the hen safety course, so
maybe.
I do have some experience in my teenage years of having a lot of chickens, or having a few number of chickens on acreage, and yeah, it was just an extension cord. But we were out in the acreage, out in rural, so it was like you made up your own rules about this.
Yeah,
and yet the chickens seem quite happy. You know, they're quite productive. So I think we got by quite well with extension cord esque stuff. But yeah, it says an electrical permit is required to install, alter, or add to an electrical system. And then it says this applies to the installation of a heat lamp, light fixture, or any other type of electrical components in an urban hen coop. I'm not sure. Is it the way that's worded? I don't know if you need a permit just to run an extension cord.
See,
hopefully it doesn't include that, but I don't know.
It's a little bit odd, because if I did the same thing in my shed, because my shed's the right dimensions, that, yeah, I didn't need to get a permit for it. It's just, yeah, an auxiliary building. If I run an extension cord to my shed and put a light on in my shed, I don't need a permit for that. If I actually run underground power and put a panel in my shed, then yes, sure, I do.
Yeah.
Is it different for a chicken coop? It almost sounds like it.
Yeah, though, when the wording is unclear.
Yeah.
And then it's interesting, because then step five is obtaining your hen license. So then you can go through and submit your application. But actually, in step four, so this isn't pulled out as a separate step, but it's in here, and I don't think it appropriately fits under the development permit. It actually says that once application has been received, including the urban chicken neighbor acceptance document. So you reading through this bylaw and it's like, okay, here's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 steps. And if you skim over that little paragraph, you will overlook the fact that if you want backyard chickens, you have to get them to consent. So your two neighbors on either side, it's interesting. I'm just thinking the form that they provide here. I'm looking at the form that they provide and it only has spots for two neighbors.
What about the one across the back alley?
That's right. Like, the guy from across the back alley. I don't know if.
Cause if your chicken coop is right up across on the back corner of your property,
yeah.
The guy across the back alley is going to be closer than the one opposite over across your yard.
Yeah. Well, yeah. There's going to be lots of scenarios
if they're considering neighbors, that probably should be included.
Yeah. So maybe they need to, I guess you'll just have to print out this form twice. In fact, it says that a person wishing to get an urban hen license must have acceptance from their neighbors on each side of the residence. So yeah, if you are the neighbor that backs on to another person, we don't care about your consent. It's just the consent on either side.
Yeah.
Again, it doesn't seem to make sense. I'm not sure what the principle of that is then. Like if it is really getting consent of people who might be affected by this,
then
you would think that backyard person might be a reasonable person to include in this, but maybe I shouldn't be mentioning this.
You're just going to make this even more onerous. Now they're going to start listening to it.
Maybe that'll just be a test of our influence.
Yeah.
But then it goes through and gives you kind of a layout of the acceptable coop that you can have. So this is a multi-step investment into getting backyard chickens.
And once you get to the end of all that, the application fee is one of the highest fees you'll find anywhere.
Yeah, so your annual chickens are going to cost you $70 licensing fee,
which is almost 2.5 times Red Deer's.
Yeah, Red Deer's at 28. There's another one that I saw at 50. I can't remember if it was. I can't remember what city it was. It was one of the smaller towns around here, but 50, 70 was seemed like the high. And so there is a lot that goes on here, and so as I was So as I was going through this, I also was checking out other bylaws. Red Deer's, that they've had theirs in place since 2014.
Yeah.
And the only overlapping element that I think is the premises identification program. So you need that, but they don't require a course. They don't require a permit. You know, if you're building a structure, then sure, you probably... But
it's just chickens. Like any other backyard structure. Yeah. If it exceeds your dimension limit, you have to get a permit.
Yeah.
That's standard.
Yeah. So if there is a permit required, it's not included in the chicken bylaw.
Yes.
As opposed to this one is. And then I didn't see any neighbor consent forms. Though maybe I should start calling it the neighbor veto power form. Because this is, you know, for me, I have no intentions of getting backyard chickens. I really don't have, you know, a chicken in this fight. It's not one thing I'm pursuing at this point. But there is some underlying kind of principles that are concerning on a larger scale, on a more fundamental scale. And this is kind of what I wanted to ask council about, and I asked them through the online meeting about why do they have a much more difficult bylaw than surrounding towns do, and it's simply the case. There is just more steps and hoops to go through for this one than there is in other ones. Red Deer probably being the simplest one. So as I was watching them kind of discuss this, Mary Arjot expressed the idea that he'd like the idea of making this bylaw more difficult, or the making it more difficult to obtain chickens. And I wanted clarity on that. Like, why?
Yeah.
That's whenever I hear a politician saying they want to make things more difficult, that makes me nervous.
Yeah.
Government officials and politicians should be far less popular and influential than they are. We just think about before phones and Facebook and telegrams, you just thought about your local area and what the president did or what the prime minister did probably was not part of your daily life. Nowadays politicians are they're basically today's celebrity. They're as well known as movie stars. And I don't think they should have that much influence in our day-to-day lives. I'll give some more ground to, you know, the fact that this is municipal and local where most of the power should be.
Yeah.
But still, even at the municipal level, the government should be involved in the least onerous way possible.
Yeah.
I think. So what was Yarjo's explanation or kind of what's his thinking when it comes to this? So I was asking these questions and it really came down to two things. Two reasons for making this license more difficult than it needs to be. First was to appease those who are opposed to urban chickens. And this is uncontroversial that this is not a universally accepted bylaw. Some people move to towns. In fact, probably most people move to towns because they don't, let's put it this way. When they move to town, they have certain expectations of what town life is like.
You're not expecting to live in a agricultural or farm animal type setting.
Yes.
You expect to live in an urban setting.
Yeah. The environment is completely different. And so you expect different kind of interactions in day-to-day living. So I get that. So in order to kind of appease that crowd, he's doesn't want to make the bylaw too easy. And kind of related to that, the second reason is that he wanted to make sure that those who actually want backyard chickens are really committed to it. And by making this process and putting these hoops in place, you ensure that there's no one's going to go into it kind of with that kind of let's get a dog kind of mentality, that there actually is some sort of buy-in to the program.
Yeah.
And again, I guess I get that, that reasoning. There's this idea of trying to appease both sides of the aisle. And perhaps it'll become a larger topic later on in the episode. But here, especially with the veto power here, this, so imagine you want backyard chickens and you are, living next to a neighbor who's actually opposed to it. You now therefore automatically don't have that right or don't have that. I don't know if rights too many, too strong. Don't have the opportunity.
No matter how prepared you are, no matter how much you're willing to commit to this, you do not get to because your neighbor doesn't want you to.
Yeah. And so that ability to walk the line that Yarjo is kind of going with, and I think especially Walsh and Denson probably are okay with this as well, since they voted against the first reading in the first place. In the first place, I don't think they're probably fine with making this as onerous as possible. There is that middle road that you're trying to form is actually gone for those people. If I'm opposed to this, I actually have complete control over what my neighbors can do about chickens.
Yeah.
So think about that. Your neighbor gets to control what you do on your property.
And
when it comes to chickens,
at least for this point in time, only for chickens.
Yeah.
If I don't want my neighbor to have, say, a dog, or I don't want my neighbor to be smoking marijuana in their backyard because I don't like the smell, I don't get to say anything about that. But if they want chickens, I can veto that decision.
Yeah.
Why?
What makes this so special?
What makes this so special, so different?
Yeah.
And
I can imagine a lot of people vetoing their neighbor's dog.
Oh yeah, for sure. Like there's some dogs out there that I definitely think don't need to be out there.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's odd. My concern is that I don't want to go that direction either, though. I don't want
no,
to.
No, that's the thing. Yeah.
I'm concerned when I see them giving you the ability to veto your neighbor's ability to do what they want with their property.
Yeah. This is not, I don't think, uncommon in Canada. We just don't have the same, strength. There's this same strength in our rights to property. The government feels a lot more free to have say over how what we do over with our own land. And this, I don't think this was a consideration when this was brought in. I asked them if this was, you know, is this a thing that this veto power that neighbors have, is that anywhere applied anywhere else to any other bylaw? And the only one that they thought may apply to is home-based businesses, and perhaps secondary suites. I haven't looked into double checking that. I don't think it's true of all businesses because I've got businesses licenses myself.
I have a business license. It has nothing to
do with it. So
unless it's a business that requires a certain amount of traffic to and from your location, then maybe I guess your neighbors could have some kind of a say in that.
Yeah.
Because mine has no,
no
customers no coming customer, to my door. Yeah. Like, it's not that kind of business license.
So there it's not universal. It's just maybe in very specific situations where you would have customers visiting that you might need that. But it's a concerning position. I think it's a concern about the fact that council feels that this is appropriate. I don't know how deeply they are thinking about this. Like I think as this is a kind of a good thing, a good neighborly thing to do. You know, ask whenever you do things
for sure.
You fix your fence or even you're putting up a shed or something like that. Like it might be just common courtesy to ask your neighbor about certain things you're going to do on your property.
But if you do have a difficult relationship with a neighbor, that should not allow your neighbor to legally prevent you from doing things on your property.
Yeah.
Great. You can be a friendly neighbor and talk to your neighbor before you do anything that may impact them, but they should not have legal recourse against you having chickens on your property or whatever other thing that may drift into in the future.
Yeah. I really hope council understands the significance of this, that this is actually allowing your neighbor to control what you do with your own private property. And that's a line that you need to be aware that you're crossing and really do so with strict limits in place. And I don't know what the limiting factor is on this one. Cause ends up treating chickens, these four backyard chickens, more like commercial farms than neighborhood, than the pet dog. And it really, we can't veto dogs or other animals. What makes this one so different? And if you're saying, well, okay, maybe this has effects, this could have effects on the standard or the property value of your neighbor or something like that. That applies to so many different things. Like if I don't repair my collapsed fence, that has a effect on people on property value. Like there's so many things that do that.
I picked the wrong color of siding.
Like
if you're going to go down that road, we're all going to be living in
could you imagine?
Absolute top down government telling us exactly what we need to do.
Yeah. So here, hopefully you can let council know, that some of these steps I think can be pared down, that this actually doesn't serve a middle of the road, pathway. I think if someone has I don't want to say you have a right to have chickens, but if there's nothing that reasonably prevents someone from doing this thing on their property, like we allow so much, you can do virtually anything on your property, and not have neighbors say you can't do that. Like that's a serious step. And then hopefully council has actually thought through this but my cynical side says they've just threw this in here because they want to make it more difficult.
Yeah.
And they want to appease those who are opposed to it, when in fact this gives all the power to those who oppose it.
Yeah.
Especially in the situations in which it mostly could affect them.
Yeah.
So it may allow chickens throughout the town, but those who don't want it can actually control their neighbors in this respect. And hopefully I think that really needs to be looked at and likely taken away.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you have to put some sort of limiting principle on this. And I don't think they've thought that through. But so that's kind of the update on chickens. Hopefully council is able to kind of pare some of this back, make it more simple, get government out as much as possible. Some of these middle of the road kind of positions are perhaps nice, but again, this might be a neighbor to neighbor thing. Like if you know you're going to upset your neighbor with chickens, then you make that decision.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you might have, people are going to be bad neighbors in some cases. Like that's just going to be how things roll, but let that be decided between neighbors.
Yeah.
Government, stay out of that. Stay off the fence. Let neighbors talk over it for themselves and figure this out. But yeah, that is what is going on the chicken front. Let council know, your thoughts on this. Let us know, if you're on board with this, if you think this is just the right amount of regulations that are required, or just too much. Definitely love to hear your feedback on this issue. Cause it'll probably come up again. We haven't even got to the second reading yet.
Yeah.
This is going to be around for a while.
This topic is not going away immediately.
Nope. All right. So sticking to news about Penhold, and this is news that is about Penhold. It's being talked about.
Yep.
Mike Yarjot, the mayor, though I think he's talking at this point in his capacity as a citizen of Penhold, and not in his capacity as mayor. He recently made a Facebook post concerning, giving his thoughts about the convoy, the Canada convoy that's moving its way or making its way across Canada. And it certainly got a lot of attention, and I thought it was worth discussing. Again, being Penhold Talk Radio, this is the talk about town. At least as the town exists on Facebook. And so I figure it'd be good to kind of go through this and kind of interact with some of his thoughts and ideas here. And so just by way of background, or if you have been off of Facebook, good for you. but no doubt this is also just making the mainstream news.
Yeah.
About a week ago now, maybe a little bit more. Probably
I think
a
it's a little over a week.
I guess started. By the time this airs, yeah, it'll definitely be about 10 days or almost 2 weeks. And there's a convoy moving across Canada made up of primarily it started with big rig truckers. And the kind of the precipitating event was the federal government's mandate to institute vaccines for anyone or for any trucker coming into Canada.
Yeah.
So if you are moving goods across Canada, across the border, if you're moving across or coming across the border, you can't get in unless you've been fully vaccinated, unless you've had your two doses. And that was put in place on the 18th, I believe, after a lot of back and forth in the news, whether it was or was not going to happen.
Well, and I believe it got delayed a number of times as well. I think it was supposed to go in earlier and they pushed it back, or they made some kind of exceptions to it. It kept changing.
As a lot of things have done at this around this time. Yeah. But nonetheless, it was put in place and quickly became big news. It's estimated that, I believe, forget the percentage. I want to say, was it? No, 5%. I think it was like some 16,000 truckers. I can't, I wish I remember the percentage. It's about 16,000 truckers that wouldn't be able to continue trucking in Canada because of this. And so this is, this started over on the West Coast and has been making its way towards Ottawa and along the way, picking up more and more people, more and more Facebook posts, more and more propaganda and fringe groups around it. So this is a very nebulous shifting scenario going on. But I think the gist of it, the main thrust of this, is that that what started with the truckers and has been picked up by a lot of other Canadians, is that they are against these vaccine mandates.
Yeah.
That's been the core central part of this. Supply lines have been only the kind of the downstream effect of this. So people aren't railing because, you know, the apples aren't in stock at the IGA. This goes back to what's causing that, and it's these vaccine mandates, and this has been affecting everyone now for going into almost 3 years. Well, I guess we're talking about vaccine mandates going on to into a year now or so. Of different restrictions regarding that. So it's been moving across town, picking up a lot of opinion and think pieces and reporting from a variety of different news groups.
Yeah.
From a variety of different angles. And so, there is a lot of, it's really hard to kind of point at what is the truth or kind of what's the main theme here, or, you know, who's in control of this thing?
Yeah.
That's probably what we were thinking of.
Like you mentioned, it's pulled in a lot with it. So it started out, like you say, the main objective is to protest the vaccine mandates, but because of some of the fringe stuff that's been kind of pulled in along the way, it's getting a lot of negative attention for various reasons. You've got a lot of people joining in that do have a bit of a different view on things. You'll see some trucks flying flags that are probably not officially part of the original cause. But so, trying to figure out what the real purpose and goal is can be a little tricky at this time, especially looking at some of the mainstream media that like to pick out the controversy.
Yeah, I think that's where most of the confusion comes from, because when you get a group this large, and the numbers have been fluctuating, like, again, how big is this group? It's not 50,000 trucks.
No,
that's actually kind of funny. That was actually kind of a meme or a thing that was going around Facebook. There's like 50,000 semis involved in this, and then people do like the calculations of how long 50,000 trucks,
even with the minimal distance between each truck, it's like this would wrap most of the way around the earth.
Not quite that, but it'd just be an absurd amount of served length. That's just certainly not the case. But perhaps to give an idea of how long it is, one report mentioned that it took about 2 hours to go through the little town of Dryden, Ontario. So, you know, let's say it's only going cruising through at 30 kilometers an hour. That's still a 60 kilometer train of vehicles that are going. Like there's a lot of people moving, moving towards Ottawa to get their voices heard, for sure. So Yarjo posts this, and I think overall the tone of his post is to try to take, again, a little bit more of a kind of a calmer approach to it.
Yeah.
Try to recognize that there's extremes that are going on, and those extremes are acting in just extremely divisive ways and pulling everyone apart. And he's trying to kind of address some of that with the kind of trying to get that middle of the road approach, as he calls himself. I think he puts himself in the middle of these groups. And so I just want, we just kind of read through little bits of these and kind of give us, again, give a little bit of a response to it. So he starts off by recommending people kind of perhaps stay off Facebook for a little bit. I completely agree with that. Yeah. That's probably a good thing.
It's a good move.
Yeah.
Very good move.
Yeah. It'll serve your sanity well. And then he offers a little bit of a kind of a rule for life as he approaches some of these issues. And the gist of it, he mentions that is nothing is ever as good as it seems or as bad as it seems. So keep that in mind as you read the rest of this post. And again, he's trying to even out or trying to convince us that things aren't as high or as low as we might think they are. And again, I think generally this is a good approach.
In the world of social media, yeah. I think that's a very good approach because we tend to, with social media, we post the best of our life or our greatest frustration. When things are kind of balanced in the middle, that gets ignored. So social media, it really is like the worst of the worst and the best of the best.
Yeah.
And so taking that mindset of nothing's quite as good as it seems or necessarily as bad as it seems is a good way to balance out what we're being presented with.
Yeah. If something normal happens, it's not going to make the news. No. And most of the time people aren't going to post about normal things. So
yeah.
Just by the nature of these beasts, you're going to already be confronted with extremes. So yes, I think this is a good idea to keep in mind that the extremes that are being portrayed, especially online, are probably not reflective of what is actually happening.
Yeah.
My one little kind of comment on that is that I wouldn't want this though to blind me to when things are actually bad or actually good. And at this time, I'm actually perhaps more concerned by the amount of complacency that a lot of Canadians have had over these last going on 3 years of the freedoms that have been taken away. There's a lot of Canadians that they're comfortable just sitting in the living room and saying, okay, I didn't really want to do that anyways, or I'm okay. I'm okay if I can't go to the restaurant now. But those are some fundamental rights that we have as Canadians and really I'll just say as humans, because I think it goes beyond just the Canadian Constitution when we're talking about these things, to be able to have that freedom of association, freedom of movement, freedom of choice when it comes to how we decide to live. And there's a lot of Canadians that have been shockingly okay with how long these restrictions have gone in place. And so I can sympathize more and understand more and appreciate more the convoy or the understanding behind the convoy, the motivation behind behind the convoy than I do with the kind of the complacent Canadian that is sadly more prevalent.
Yep.
And so, yeah, try to keep an even keel unless there's something that needs a reaction.
Yeah.
There's some things that you can't take middle of the road about, that you shouldn't remain necessarily calm about. There's some times when you need to be raising your arms and getting people's attention to something.
Yep.
And I can understand that people think that this is that time now. Get people's attention that your freedoms have taken away and at least express some sense of disgruntlement at least with that. Don't be so complacent and compliant about some of these things. But anyways, he goes on, he talks about how there's people on both sides. He says there's, of this issue, that's really good to see. And I hope, you still care about these issues. Though he says that he promised that a road trip to an F Trudeau or a road trip to Ottawa with an F Trudeau flag won't do a thing to address these issues. These issues being the supply lines, but I think more broadly the mandate issues that they're opposed to. Now, this is perhaps, and so yeah, he continues on. If we can acknowledge that this road trip won't do anything. that this road trip isn't really about Canadian supply lines so much as it is about anti-vaccine and anti-mandate activists hijacking a legitimate cause and potential national security concern in order to raise money and build influence so they can raise even more money. There's nothing wrong with being opposed to these things, by the way, but many of the people claiming to lead this movement are not being honest, and there is something wrong with that. All right, so there's a couple of points in here that I think are worthy of addressing. I disagree with the fact that this was ever about supply lines. Again, to go back, that's kind of a downstream effect of what they're really going against is the mandates.
Yeah, I think that it's always been about the mandates. And I think the fact that the truckers are the ones that are doing this, obviously the supply chain part is going to come in. Because they are a crucial part of the supply chain. So they're using the protest to also point out that if you continue with these mandates, it's going to affect supply chains. But I don't think the supply chains was the initial catalyst for this.
No. So I don't think there's been a hijacking of this.
No.
I think this has always been a response to mandates. And the mandates or the vaccine mandates against truckers just provided a spark.
Yeah.
And that spark started with the truckers. And because the mandates have affected everybody, it's easy to see how so many other people got involved with this.
Yeah.
This was just about supply lines. Yeah. I don't think it would be as broad of an issue. No one, like I said,
no.
When was the last time you thought about how your groceries get to the market or get to your grocery store? And when was the last time you thought about protesting about the fact that toilet paper was low at the grocery market or at the superstore or something like that? Like you just don't.
Yeah.
This has always been, I think, always been about the mandates and whether and opposing those. So I don't think there's been a hijacking. I think it's a mischaracterization that's going on here, and a bit of a selling short of the seriousness of this.
Yeah.
He mentions that the people that this has been hijacked and that people who are running this are dishonest and greedy, it would seem. He doesn't provide kind of any evidence or link to that. I would think if he had put out those assertions, he would help me understand his position, where he came to that. Again, with such a large group, you are going to get people making statements that seem like they're in association with this convoy that seem to be trying to move in a different direction. But those are fringe groups that are going to be a part of any large movement.
Yeah.
So to categorize this whole thing as being led by dishonest people, or hijacking this in one way or the other, I would like to see more reasons behind that.
And that's a pretty harsh accusation against the individuals that did arrange this and organize it. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty harsh accusation. You really need some kind of evidence, something to back that position.
Yeah.
To say that they're only out there to raise money and build influence and being dishonest, that's not fair.
Yeah, no, especially without providing some evidence for it. And the one or two guys on Facebook who might fit that criteria, you can't apply that to the whole group.
Yeah.
So he continues on, we've built ourselves a system where raising money and producing content to sell comes before responsible leadership. And it breaks my heart to see. I have friends and family who I love dearly and will continue to love falling into these rabbit holes, and I have friends who have followed every rule and restriction to the letter and want to see others who haven't put in jail. Okay, so I'll pause there. He's equating two different groups here. Seemingly one has gone down this rabbit hole, as he calls it, being led away, I'm guessing, by these dishonest leaders of the convoy. I think that's what he's...
That seems to be the implication.
Yeah, he goes on to talk about the money we'll read about in a second. So it seems like maybe they're being led to believe that this is about something when it's really about something else. And then he equates it to others who would like to see those who haven't followed the rules put in jail. That's to me is a tough balancing between those two. One actually, at least on the outside, and I think most people behind it, ignore the leadership. You know, well, we can talk about that in a little bit. Ignore the leadership behind the convoy. People who are the people who are constituting the mass of this movement, the actual populace of this, I think are driven by this idea of wanting to remove mandates and restore their freedoms.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's not a rabbit hole.
No,
that to me is a sincere and honest pursuit. And to equate those with people who want to see the unvaccinated or the rule breakers thrown in jail, that's not a comfortable equivocation on my part.
Yeah, I certainly don't see those as extremes. One's an extreme; the other is somewhat reasonable.
Yeah, we looked at and sadly, there's a lot of people in that let's put them in jail camp as we looked at.
Yeah,
in our last podcast. So, and then, so he continues, it's not good. I can't stay quiet anymore. We have now given over $5 million to a makeshift group with no accountability or oversight through either a GoFundMe campaign or personal e-transfers. This money comes primarily from older Canadians or generally less engaged ones who in many cases believe they are supporting something real and meaningful. And in a lot of ways, it is nothing like they think it is. So just to update his numbers, it's over 6.5 million now, at least at the recording of this episode. No doubt is going to cross the 7 million mark, which is just a stunning number. And then he mentions that there's no accountability or oversight for these funds. And to me that strikes as a very kind of political or like someone who's been in the system a lot, like just a politician. They like the oversight and accountability. Remember, this is a private enterprise. These are private funds being given freely. So it certainly doesn't need the accountability of, say, elected officials and the funding that they say. So, you know, sure. Yes. If you're giving money, you want to give it to a reputable organization. I think he's missing the point though of the money.
Yeah. I don't think people are giving so much that they, I don't think they so much care about where their money is going so much as to show the support for the cause.
Yes.
To signal like the fact that we've raised, I say we, I'm not part of this, but the fact that it's raised nearly $7 million from, I think you were saying earlier, 85,000 donors. That's showing the seriousness of the issue and how many people really do care. It's easy to get people to sign a petition, but it's not easy to get people to fork out a few bucks each.
Yeah.
Like this is, and it's not a substantial amount of money per person.
No.
Like when you look at how many donors.
Yeah. When it's averaged out, it's around the $5,200 mark for most people.
It's enough that people can show that this matters to them. And a lot of people are saying this matters to them.
Yeah. So yeah, this isn't about people, when people donate to this. Yeah. I don't think they are doing it, checking or making sure that their $50 is going to make sure it goes I don't think they're concerned about where that money goes through. I think most of it by looking at that, this, I don't think there's reason to think there's anything super nefarious going on here. It's just a lot of money to look after. There's one thing to say that there's a scam going on. I don't think there's reason for the scam.
Yeah.
I don't be surprised if some of this money is hard to track down in the end, but this money is more about signifying their support for this cause.
Yeah.
So, I think your comparison about signing a petition and actually giving out money is significant. There's one thing to collect 85,000 signatures, which is a lot.
Yeah. Even not a small accomplishment.
No,
but it's puny compared to getting 85,000 people to give money.
Yeah, try to get 50 bucks from 85,000 people.
You ever try a door-to-door campaign of even selling a product as a fundraiser, never mind just asking for money?
Yeah, that's right.
And it's not easy to get a lot of people to jump on board. People don't want to just give out money or even buy a product. And this is just saying, okay, well, 85,000 people care enough to give money.
Yeah, to the tune of now almost $7 million. And so this focus on, and I don't know where he gets this idea where there's old people and less engaged people. Yeah. Again, he seems to be speaking of this as like a scam. I don't see where there's evidence that this is some sort of large scale scam going on. But I think again, he misses the point. This is $7 million of support, worldwide support.
Yeah.
For freedom. Like that's how people view it. You can say that leadership may think leadership is corrupt. What people are donating is not to the leadership. They're donating to this cause that they are opposed to these mandates. They've had enough of these mandates, and they are sick and tired of the government thinking that they control everything in their lives and telling them what they can and can't do at every moment of the day now.
Yeah. And I think that's a key point, is that even if this all blows apart and the money gets stolen, leadership turns into a big fraud.
Yeah.
That doesn't change why people donated the money and the significant amount of support that signals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's to miss the point. If you're focused on whether or not this money is actually used to fuel the convoy or not, that's to miss the point. This is $7 million to fight for freedom as a sign of how much your freedom is worth to you, at least for the people who've donated to here. And that cannot be discounted simply by saying that perhaps leadership doesn't have enough oversight.
Yeah. Obviously we want the money to be well spent.
But that's not the main point of this money. So he goes on, and I think as a final point, he kind of at the end provides some of his perspective on what kind of good leaders do. He recognizes that protests are a fundamental right. He says it's okay to be against vaccine passport programs and COVID restrictions, just as it's okay to be in support of them. There's this middle ground. He loves that middle ground.
Yep.
Good leaders can have compassion and empathy for both those groups, just as they can for the majority of us stuck in the middle, watching their friends tear each other apart. Good leaders don't exploit that and take advantage of people. So keep that in mind. This idea of compassion and empathy is central to his view of leadership. Because he continues on a little bit later, he says, we are tired and stressed and emotionally drained. Heck, I'm tired and a little angry myself, but I refuse to take that out on others. And instead, I commit myself to working for change in a responsible way. We need leaders with compassion and empathy. And what we are getting is glorified internet content producers standing on a street corner with a bullhorn asking for our money. He can't help but get that cynicism coming through regarding this. But anyway, he continued to just finish up. Good leaders know what it takes to make real change. It takes time, commitment, compassion, empathy, and most importantly, responsibility. There's a lot of good leaders out there, but not every one of them wants to be one. Follow the good ones and have faith. We'll get through this together. All right. So here's the kind of the big thought or big idea is, do we want our leaders, and particularly in this case, our political leaders, to be acting with compassion and empathy?
it sounds like good. Such it a good thing, right. Yeah. But you can't make both sides of an issue happy. You can't please them both. If you're trying to be empathetic and compassionate to both sides on an issue, you end up treading down the middle and making neither of them happy and not accomplishing anything. And it's showing a sign of kind of no principle on the issue. You're just trying to appease both sides because of your empathy towards both.
Yeah. So you end up getting, if there is a principle involved, the principle is, I know I've done the right thing when perhaps both sides are not liking what I've decided. And you kind of get this, I've got the middle road if both sides are throwing things at me or not happy with the decision.
As long as you haven't thoroughly angered both sides, but both sides aren't really happy, you're kind of treading down the middle and doing okay.
Yeah, so you end up getting I think if you're a leader that's kind of governed by this compassion, empathy, you are going to be drawn to do either what's in the middle of the road, in which case no one is satisfied. And really, who says the middle of the road is better than any of the other two sides? Or you're going to be pulled into the direction of the person you feel most sorry for.
Yeah.
You're going to be driven by your emotions, or at least the emotions of other people, whoever can make you feel more empathetic towards, whoever can tell you the better sob story, or plead their case better in kind of an emotionally tugging way. That's you're going to tend to side towards them if you weren't already sympathetic more towards them in the first place. But what I want to see from a political leader is someone who has a governing principle and sets policies based upon those principles, because then I know what direction they're going to go in.
Yeah.
Someone, a government or a leader who's governed by the empathy of people behind him isn't really leading. He's just going wherever the emotions of his followers are going to go.
Yeah, you have no way to know what they're going to do
in
a given situation, where somebody that actually governs by a grounding principle, when you vote them in, you can have some expectation of what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody that's governing on empathy, they're going to sway wherever the
emotional wind pushes them. That makes it hard to say you're a leader when you're just being pulled by the emotions of your followers. And so as nice as well, we're probably sounding pretty cool hearted. But I think there has to be a coldness, particularly when it comes to the politics, because you're usually dealing with principles on a large scale.
Yeah.
But when we're talking about compassion, empathy, that's towards individuals, or at least more towards you're empathetic towards your neighbor or towards, you know, your kids or something like that. It's more individual specific focus. There's no way you can empathize with everybody, especially at a federal, provincial level, and create policy that's going to actually satisfy all those feelings of those people. There's just no way you're going to do it. So compassion, empathy, yes, good on a personal relationship level. Yes, I want that. You don't want the cold-hearted neighbor who puts up chicken coops just regardless of what you think. But when it comes to people who are instituting policies that affect a wide range of people over a wide range of circumstances, you want that done on a more principled level.
Yeah.
And that's where I think, I would disagree with Yarjo here. And this is where I think, it's helpful for me as a voter to know which kind of leader I'm going to follow, because they're the leaders who aren't going to be swayed by the emotional swings of the populace. They're not looking at the latest poll numbers. They are driven by an objective principle, and moving in that direction. And I can say, okay, I know what direction this car is getting or going in. Do I want to get on board?
Yeah.
And that's who I want to be picking. I don't want someone who's going to be steering the car based upon the backseat drivers.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I imagine going on here. So yes, good. It sounds good. You know, this whole empathy, middle of the road, try to get along to get by. But I think ultimately you end up with leaders that just pulled all over the place, and you don't know what direction you're going to end up going. So in the end, you know, I appreciate, to kind of go full circle, I appreciate, you know, the counselors that actually take the stand, know where they are, and will stay in that direction. So Denson and Walsh, you know, even though they voted against the whole chicken bylaw, I especially knowing Walsh, I know what reasoning he's applying to there. He's not trying to appease the people who want chicken.
Yeah.
And he just doesn't put, I'm going to put words in his own mouth. He doesn't care.
Yeah.
And in a sense, I don't want my politician to care. I want my politician to act on principle.
Yeah.
And because then I know where things are going to go, and that predictability is good. And so if nothing else, I want leaders that are principled and not ones that are empathetic. And I know that probably makes me sound cold and mean. But that's the way I want it. That's what my emotions are telling me.
Well, there you go. Yeah, as long as your emotions say that, then that's what they should do.
That's right. All right. I think we've yammered on long enough. If you made it this far, thank you. You have endured to the end. We appreciate your listenership. Provide your feedback. We'd love to hear from you, interact with you. Just as a final thought, soon we'll be starting to send out some invitations for people to perhaps guest if they dare. Just a casual conversation, get other voices involved in here. If there's people in Pendle that you would like to hear their thoughts, opinions, background, stories, if you think there's someone who perhaps deserves a little bit of camera time, let us know. I want to make this, we want to make this podcast Penhold centric as much as possible and kind of help facilitate the building up of a community. And part of that is getting to know our local neighbors. If there's a name out there that you kind of want to hear from or think would be a fun guest, let us know. But hopefully soon someone will brave the cameras and the lights and come on and we can hear from a different perspective. But in the meantime, thank you again for joining us. My name is Brian Constein.
And I'm Michael Rowland.
And this has been Penhold Talk Radio.